compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, 888-914-9149. I like rickrolling people as much as the next guy. And when you say rickrolling, you're talking about Rick Astley, right? Yeah, I'm talking about Rick Astley. This guy. The guy who's like 13 years old with his own music video. And it was, I mean, this was a serious song back in 1987, Never Gonna Give You Up.
Serious? Is that the right word?
Well, serious. Let me put it this way. This was a big hit in 1987.
Okay. It was a hit, definitely.
You were playing with Legos in 1987.
I wasn't listening to this.
Most of America was. He's 55 now, but he... I'm going to do some mental math. So that means that he would have been 6 years old. He would have been 21 when this song came out.
21, looks like he's going on 13.
When you hear his voice and then you see him, it's incongruous. So here's why we're doing this. Okay, you can pipe him down. Rick Astley, that guy, was actually confused the first time he got rickrolled. Yeah. Rickrolling refers to people who are tricked into clicking on a hyperlink that leads to the music video to his single. The clip has since reached more than a billion views on YouTube. A billion views on YouTube. He admitted he was really annoyed at first by this trend. It's only picked up steam. He says his daughter helped him warm up to it. This is an article by Samantha Ibrahim, by the way. He recently chatted about this iconic single, getting rickrolled himself. He revealed that his friend, who was living in California, rickrolled him. He says, before I even knew what it was. Even just the few beats of the snare drum at the very beginning.
That's all you need.
Let me just get that snare drum. Let me hear that. There it is. And it's an electronic snare drum. So he said, he remembers saying to himself, why is he sending me this? And my video just suddenly shows up. I kept asking myself, what is he doing?
Rick Astley got rickrolled?
Rick Astley got rickrolled. And he didn't understand it.
That's good. Yeah,
he understands it now. That's for sure. But I don't know how much people can take, how much longer they can take.
I can do this all day.
I know. What does that say about us? All right, to the phones. Let us go to let's go to Kendra in Albuquerque. Hi, Kendra. Kendra, you need to be off your speakerphone, my dear.
Okay.
Perfect. Have you ever been rickrolled?
Okay. Let's go to someone else. I'll pick up.
Kendra, we'll come back to you. We're gonna come back to you. Let's go to Blanca in Chicago. Hi, Blanca.
I had a question about a book you had talked about a while ago. One of my kids asked me once, like, how do we know we're in the right church? So I went ahead and I ordered your book on Surprised by Truth, and it really helped me a lot. I never had questioned my Catholicism until this kid comes and asks me.
I'm glad.
And it helped me a lot. So now I have a lot of good words to share with my children of why the Catholic Church is the fullness of the truth. Mm-hmm. And, but now one of them asked me, like, how do we even know that God exists? And I remember you had mentioned the book that said that it was easier to prove that God exists rather than to prove that he doesn't exist. Like, it's easier to prove that he does exist when people run around
I would say it's impossible to prove that God doesn't exist. That would be an impossibility.
Oh, you see, yes. But it's easier, and a lot of people think, like, oh, you can't prove that, like, that's not provable. So, and he's a smart kid, makes smart questions.
Mm-hmm. So that's the best kind of kid.
Needs help.
That's the best kind of kid, so right there.
I explained, you know, that's good. This is not a bad thing, because once you know the answer, you're just much more confident and solid about things, you know? So now I'm trying to figure out what that book is so that I can read it and maybe share it.
Sure. Also. There are several, actually. It's several that I would recommend. So the first thing is to point out to him, or, you know, at least just for yourself, to be aware of the fact that the proof for the existence of God, as well as disproof for the existence of God, ultimately, I think we would have to say you can't prove it with mathematical certainty, but you can show that the rationality, the reasonableness of believing in the existence of God is overwhelming, as opposed to the alternative, which is to believe that no God exists. I think that it's far, 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 far more reasonable, based upon the evidence, to assume that God exists. But we don't seek to prove it with mathematical certitude, because God is not susceptible to those things. God is not susceptible to science, meaning that you can't either prove or disprove that God exists based upon science, because science has nothing to say about whether or not God exists. Science deals only with pre-given physical realities, the things that our senses can observe and measure and quantify, etc. The proofs, if we want to call them that, or the rational reasons to believe that God exists, that falls into the domain of philosophy, insofar as we use our powers of reason, we use our powers of logic to eliminate certain things that we understand couldn't be true, and then we can also say some things that can be true about God, but it's not reducible to a scientific experiment, for example, nor is it reducible to probabilities, as some atheists try to do. So here are some books, and it's just a variety of books that will help you. One, and I'll start with a book that I co-authored with Kenneth Hensley. The book is called The Godless Delusion. Now, that's a riff on Richard Dawkins' famous book called The God Delusion. Richard Dawkins, perhaps the most prominent atheist nowadays, his thesis in that book, and it's one of several books that he's written to try to promote atheism, his thesis is that if you believe in God, you're basically deluded. You're basically crazy, because you're superstitiously believing in something for which he argues there is no evidence. Now, of course, I don't accept that view. So what we did in our book called The Godless Delusion is, rather than offer the proofs for the existence of God or the arguments for the existence of God, which many other authors have done, we thought we would do something a bit different, and we thought we would critique the Dawkins approach to atheism and to say, can atheism withstand a critical analysis? And our answer to that is no. And so the book is our critique of the claims of atheism. So if you're interested in it, if you're interested in that angle, that would be a book I'd suggest. So, The Godless Delusion. A second book is a book written by someone under a pseudonym by the name of Vox Day, but it's called The Irrational Atheist. And in this book, the author goes after Dawkins and Harris and, you know, Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens, perhaps the three most commonly known atheists nowadays. And so it is a thoroughgoing critique of their arguments in favor of atheism. And I won't bother to try to give you a book report on that book, but that's a book that I thought was interesting and useful. So again, that's called The Irrational Atheist. I would propose a book called New Proofs for the Existence of God. This is by Father Robert Spitzer. Excellent book. It's a bit heady, so it depends on how advanced your child is. But if he's advanced enough, this book would be helpful to him. And another book that I'd suggest would be a book called Science in the Afterlife Experience, and that's by Chris Carter. Now, that book is entirely scientific in its approach to the phenomena of people having near-death experiences, or there is biomedical death registered by the machines, and yet the consciousness of the person continues after biomedical death and then comes back. So this book is a scientific survey of these phenomena, trying to look at this from a scientific standpoint, not a religious standpoint, but trying to evaluate this scientifically to say, this seems to suggest that there is a life beyond this life, which would open the door to the possibility of the existence of God. I would recommend a book by Dr. Edward Fazer. It looks like Fesser, but it's pronounced Fazer, F-E-S-E-R. He's a professor of philosophy at Pasadena City College in Southern California. And among his many books, one really good one is called The Last Superstition. And it, too, is a thoroughgoing critique of modern atheism. And he just, in my view, he dismantles it piece by piece. He's a very good writer, and he's a very sharp intellect. So that would be another book I would recommend. Another book I'd recommend is Handbook of Catholic Apologetics, co-authored by Father Ron Tisselli and Dr. Peter Kraft, both philosophers at Boston College. And the first roughly 20-25% of the book deals with how to respond to atheism. So all the major atheist arguments and many of the minor ones are all brought forward and destroyed one by one. So that would be another very good book on the topic. Now, there are others, and I don't mean to say that, you know, this is the sum total of books that I would recommend, but I've already overloaded you. But if you were to get any or all of these books, I think you would be so far ahead in terms of your ability to explain this to your son. And if he's willing to read them, I think he's going to be deeply challenged in any doubts that he might have about the existence of God. I think it will help him a great deal.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Call me back in a couple months after he's read some of these books and let me know. Or maybe he wants to call and we can talk about it.
Oh, yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah. All right, Blanca. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to James in Lake Elsinore, California. Good morning, James.
Good morning. I just have a question. Do you ever feel that it's a tad misleading, or dare I say lying, to present the doctrine of the communion of saints as simply, quote unquote, asking for prayers like you would a buddy at your local church? I mean, if you look at historically where this doctrine has been, it's quite clear that it's a little bit more than simply asking for prayers. Don't you feel that it might be a bit, like I say, misleading to people?
How does it seem misleading to you?
I mean, we'll leave the Mary issue alone because that's another thing. However, when it comes to the communion of saints, like if you look at ancient prayer books that have the Nile Obstat or the, imprimatur, it's quite clear, like, you'll read prayers like, oh, St. Joseph, you are my powerful protector. Please help me with X request. And then it says, like, Pope Gregory the 19th states that everyone who says this for 8 Sundays in a row shall receive remission for their sins and will never die by fire. You know, like, it's quite obvious that it's a bit deeper than just asking for prayers. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I mean, and then not only that, like at my local parish, now there's this thing like consecration to St. Joseph. I get the idea of consecrating yourself to Mary. At least she's considered sinless in Catholic theology. But Joseph was a sinner like us. I've seen my parish priest try and lead the congregation in a quote-unquote, you know, consecration to St. Joseph, in which he kneels down in front of a statue and then says a beautiful prayer. But once again, like, it seems like it's quite deeper than just asking for prayers. It seems misleading.
Well, I don't agree that it's misleading, but I do agree that it's more than just asking for prayers.
You think it is just asking for prayers, or you think it's deeper? Or?
No, I do think it's deeper. The basis of the communion of saints, biblically at least, is asking for their intercession. There's no doubt about that. But it would be simplistic or facile to suggest, not that you are, but to suggest that the communion of saints is reducible solely to that. I mean, there's much more to it than that. And you've identified a couple of examples where in Catholic piety, the church approves of these acts of piety that include devotion to Our Lady or devotion to the saint, Saint Joseph, for example, who, although he may not have been entirely sinless in this life, he certainly is sinless in heaven, that's for sure, and that's what really matters, is that you're not invoking his intercession as a man when he was alive at the time, but who he is now. And he's completely sinless in heaven before God, as all the saints are. So, yeah, you're right. There is more to it. It's much deeper. I'm not sure where the misleading part of it comes up because, I mean, if you look at the catechism, you see that it does discuss things like devotions and novenas and things of that nature. So it's not as though the church is hiding that from public view. It's right out there in the open. So although I understand your point and I agree with that part of it, I'm not sure where the misleading part is coming from or why you would think the church is being misleading.
I just think that it is misleading because there are many Catholic apologists, and I appreciate how you've just presented and stated, you know, the reality as far as what I've seen with my own eyes and, mm-hmm. you know, where this religious piety has been and where it even still is to this day. But like I say, there are Catholic apologists who will just say, we're just asking for prayers, guys. That's it. Just like you're asking your old buddy Frank to pray for you. And it's clearly deeper than that. Now, I'm not, you know, trying to attack it, but it mm-hmm. does seem, at least I feel like I was misled, you know, on this topic. You know, I had to look for myself to discover this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, fair enough. I mean, it's far be it from me to argue with your own experience. And I can't, you know, I'm not an apologist for whoever the apologists are that you feel fell short. But I mean, I can try to represent what the Catholic Church teaches on this issue. If you're interested, James, I wrote a mini treatise on the topic. It's called Any Friend of God's is a Friend of Mine. And although I don't get very deep into things like devotions or novenas, I do have a separate article on that topic, though. If you're interested in the article, it's free. It's a PDF. And if you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll see there where it says links. And when you click on the links, you'll see a link for articles. And all of these PDFs are available for free. And you can download it, print it, whatever you want to do. It's yours for the taking. But I would draw your attention to that one particular one, which is Any Friend of God's is a Friend of Mine. I think that might give you some more food for thought.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your, you know, your input and response on the issue. Thank you.
You got it, James. Thank you very much. Appreciate your phone call. It's always an interesting topic in any case. 888-914-9149. I just tested the link. I wanted to make sure that it worked, and it does work. So, again, if you want this or any of my other articles that are posted there, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Bookmark it on your computer or your phone. And then where it says links kind of toward the upper part of the page, when you open that, you'll see a bunch of different links, and the one you want is called Articles by Patrick. And that will take you to the page where all the articles are listed, and they're all yours for free. And again, the particular one I would suggest is called Any Friend of God's is a Friend of Mine. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Hey, there's a line open, so now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.
You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principalsclasses.com/Madrid.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Have a question?
Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We're back, and I'm feeling led to Line 10 to talk to Arlene in Plumas Lake, California. Good morning, Arlene.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I
have to ask that.
Okay,
perfect. So my question is, I found out recently that your baptism date, the day that you got baptized, should be celebrated like your birthday. And I wanted to find out if you know a little bit more about that.
Well, I would respectfully say to whoever told you that, that is a it's a fine idea. It's certainly a pious notion, but it's by no means required by the church. It's not something that the church says you must observe your baptismal day. I don't even know the exact date of my baptism. I could look it up, but I know it was about 2 weeks after I was born. I know where I was baptized, but we've never celebrated my baptism day, and it's not a custom in most of the Catholic world to do that. So if you did it, that would be nice. Nothing wrong with it, but the church doesn't require it. And at least from what I can see, that would be just some pious notion that this good person has, but it's not something that's shared in the universal church in any general way.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call. 888-914-9149. I say that I know where I was baptized. I was there, but I didn't really... have any memories of it, but you know, I've thought about that church, and sometime next time I'm in Southern California, I plan on popping in there and, you know, and seeing the place. But you could do that too. I mean, if you know where you were baptized, you could even stop in and maybe ask them for a copy of your baptismal certificate. Wouldn't that be interesting? And the secretary will say, sure, that'll be $5 or what have you. And she'll come back with a copy of your baptismal certificate. And that can be not just a keepsake, but also can be a great tangible reminder of the very first of the sacraments that you ever received. And if you're asking, well, where was I baptized? I was baptized at St. Mary of the Assumption Catholic Church in Whittier, California. And I haven't been back there in a long, 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 long time, but maybe I'll go back there one of these days. Let's go to Erica now in Ham Lake, Minnesota. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. So I have a question about allowing death in a hospital when you have the resources to, you know, intubate, perform CPR, give life-saving medications. Where is that approved by the Catholic Church to withhold that support?
Okay. Well, I mean, you could consult a catechism for, you know, the verbiage that talks about how under normal circumstances, the patient, it's obligatory to provide a patient with the basic necessities of life. So oxygen, food, hydration. That's not always possible. So in the case of somebody whose body is breaking down and shutting down, in some cases, the person is no longer physically able to accommodate, to receive, or to assimilate food, for example. But that would be, as I understand, a relatively rare occurrence. Most of the time, people are able to receive hydration and nutrition. So the church says, under ordinary circumstances, that must be given. You can't withhold that, just like you couldn't suck all the oxygen out of the room and expect the person to live, because you would be proactively hastening death. But on the other hand, there are situations where the person is being kept alive through extraordinary means. And that could be a ventilator, for example, or it could be some other type of extraordinary measure that if the physicians tell the family, you know, this is all that's keeping her alive, and if this were to get turned off, she would die. Well, there is nothing immoral, the church says, if the family decides after consulting with physicians and they realize this is the only thing keeping this person alive, they're more than welcome to continue that therapy. They're more than welcome to continue it as long as they wish, but they wouldn't be doing something immoral. They wouldn't be killing grandma, so to speak, if they were to unplug the ventilator. That would be considered morally permissible. And as difficult a decision as it would be, it's still something that the church says under these extraordinary conditions, the family can decide to terminate the extraordinary means and then see what happens. Does that answer your question?
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. I have a little bit of a secondary question.
Sure.
So working in healthcare, am I obligated to provide those support measures to somebody who wouldn't normally want them or to offer them?
So do you mean like a do not resuscitate order, that kind of thing?
Yes. Yes.
Well, here's where it gets a little bit more not ambiguous, but a little bit more murky for this reason. If somebody, let me use a scenario. Let's say you've got an 85-year-old man who says, you know, if I have a heart attack or if I have a stroke or if I have something else, I don't want you to try to revive me and save my life. I'm old, I'm tired, I want to go. And if you comply with that wish, you're not doing anything immoral, okay? If he has this event and is in the hospital bed, and let's say he's in a coma, but he's still alive, he's still breathing, and you didn't necessarily do anything to resuscitate him, you do still have the obligation to provide him with hydration and nutrition. You can't just say, well, he didn't want to be resuscitated, therefore we'll starve him to death. You couldn't do that. That would be immoral. Presuming, of course, that he was able to assimilate the food. So this is where sometimes the circumstances are going to dictate what would be morally permissible or not. If somebody goes into cardiac arrest, and let's say that same man goes into cardiac arrest and he has a do not resuscitate order, which means don't take out the paddles and shock him back into, you know, the proper heart rhythm, you would not be doing anything immoral if you complied with his wishes and didn't do that. But let's take a different scenario. I would propose that under Catholic moral principles, that let's say it's not an 85-year-old man, let's say it's a 35-year-old woman, mother of three or four children, and she does not have a do not resuscitate order, and she goes into cardiac arrest, and you have the paddles there that you could use to shock her into, you know, back into heart rhythm, and you didn't do something to help her when she really needed help, I would say that would be immoral. Because now you're dealing with a scenario where somebody really does need the help and they haven't said that they don't want it. So to intentionally withhold it from somebody who would almost certainly survive if you help them, I would say that would cross the line into something immoral. And there are probably many other scenarios we could think about. So that's why some of these general principles can be applied to specific cases, and then you can see on a case-by-case basis where that line is. Do you see what I'm
driving at? That clarifies
a
lot.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Let me send you with a parting gift. There's a good book. If you're in healthcare, you'll love this book. It will help you a great deal. It's called Life Issues, Medical Choices, and it's co-authored by Dr. Janet Smith. She's not a medical doctor. She has a PhD, but she taught ethics and bioethics and morality. So Dr. Janet Smith is the one author. The other author is Dr. Chris Kazor, K-A-C-Z-O-R, I think it's spelled. And it is a book that covers from A to Z almost all the typical real-world scenarios, like the one that you just mentioned. And it explains in any given situation what would be the moral or immoral thing to do. I think you'll find it very helpful.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Great to talk to
you. What was that book called?
That's called Life Issues, Medical Choices.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for getting that posted. Let's go to Teresa now in Huntington Beach, California. Hi, Teresa.
Hello, Patrick.
Hi.
I was watching on the Amazon Prime, and there was a four-part show called The Days of Noah.
Okay.
And the first part was really interesting, and it was good on how they showed in geography with the Grand Canyon, with the flood. Okay. And I found it interesting, and then I watched the second part, which was Judgment Something, and that was good as well. But then the third part I had a hard time with. It was the Valley of Decision. Have you watched this? Are you familiar with this?
No, but I just looked it up as you mentioned it. I haven't seen it. It does look interesting, but I don't know anything about it other than what you're telling me. So what was it about the third episode that bothered you?
It was the Mark of the Beast.
Okay.
And it's referencing the Catholic Church as the beast.
Okay.
And it was indicating the how in the Ten Commandments, how the church is above God with the commandment on changing the Sabbath.
Okay. This is what I thought it might be. Okay. This guy, I just looked it up, Doug Batchelor, he's the guy behind a series called Amazing Facts. He's a Seventh-day Adventist apologist. And for many years, he's produced these slick videos that purport to demonstrate that the Catholic Church is the whore of Revelation, the whore of Babylon, that the Pope is the Antichrist and or the beast of Revelation. And so this is a cottage industry for him. He's been doing it for many years. And that's the whole, I shouldn't say the whole, but that's a big part of Seventh-day Adventist polemics is since the time of Ellen Gould White, the founder of Seventh-day Adventism, she and they have been railing against the Catholic Church. And it tends to pivot on the issue of Sabbath worship. So the bee in her bonnet was Sabbath worship. And she argued that because Sunday worship is, in her view, a sign of apostasy from the truth, that true believers will worship on the Sabbath, not on Sunday, and that if you worship on Sunday, that's effectively speaking the mark of the beast. You've taken the mark of the beast, not in a physical sense, but you are cooperating with the Antichrist system because you're worshiping on Sunday the first day of the week instead of Sabbath day, which is the seventh day of the week. So that's the hobby horse, and everything comes back to that. And not just the Sabbath worship, but also the idea that Armageddon is right around the corner, and the Pope of Rome is either the Antichrist or he's the beast, and the Catholic Church is the whore of Babylon. I'm repeating myself now, but it's worth repeating because that's the whole shtick. And so all of this, you know, all of the hoopla and all the tub thumping and all of the, you know, hooping and hollering about biblical prophecy, all of it is intended to show that the Catholic Church is the things that I just said. So since I had never heard of this thing about Noah, I did look at the person's people behind it, and he's one of them. So I could tell you that it's worthless as far as I'm concerned. And no wonder you found the third section. I'm surprised it took that long before they got into the nitty-gritty.
It was done. I was surprised on how well it was presented, meaning the first 2 hours, the first, well, 4 hours. So by the time I got to the third one, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. But they did it. It's just concerning on how well it was presented.
Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately, in this world, there are people who are peddling something that's false. And I don't doubt that he believes it. I'm sure he's sincere. I've never met him. So I don't know him personally. I have no personal animus against him. But I would say, based upon what he says and what he teaches, he's a false teacher. And the false teachers are a dime a dozen. And unfortunately, sometimes the packaging is very pretty and it's very persuasive. This is why there are so many Jehovah's Witnesses going door to door in neighborhoods. This is why there are so many people of other religious beliefs who have sincerely bought into a religious system that they believe is true, but in fact is not true. Nonetheless, in spite of their sincerity, they are promoting things that are not true. So the best thing I could suggest would be just simply ignore it. You know, don't go back to it. Now, if you're a glutton for punishment and you want to see how bad it will get, assuming that you are biblically astute and you know your faith well enough, that, you know, you could do that if you wanted to, but if you have the stomach for it. But if you don't, and if you're not prepared, quite frankly, to deal with the errors that will be there, in other words, if you're not sure you'll be able to spot the errors, then maybe the best thing to do would be to avoid it so as not to get confused. But if you're up to it, then, you know, you could see how bad it's
going to
get.
Well, it just stirred me to educate myself even further. So,
yeah. There's a book, Teresa, and since this is coming from a Seventh-day Adventist perspective, there's a book that I referenced, and it's a book that I would refer you to. I don't have it in my studio, so I can't like pick it up and give you the specifics, but I believe the title is called It's Okay to Not Be Seventh-day Adventist, and it's a book written by a Catholic woman who was raised as a Seventh-day Adventist. She was raised to believe all this stuff. And she left Seventh-day Adventism and became Catholic. So this is not only her own story, but also, to a certain extent, a refutation of some of these wild claims that they make. And that might be of interest to you as an antidote, if nothing else.
It's called It's Okay Not to Be a Seventh-day Adventist.
Right. And you know what I'll do? At the next break, which is coming up here in just a minute, I will look it up and I'll get the actual title and I'll read it for you on the air. So just keep listening, and I'll be sure to read it for you so that you can get it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Patrick.
And you know what? I just found it. Bingo bango.
Oh.
So I was right. It's Okay Not to Be a Seventh-day Adventist, and the author is Teresa Beam, B-E-E-M, Teresa Beam. And
great
that
first
book,
name. Okay.
I have it in my library. I'm not finished reading it, but what I've read thus far looks really good.
Terrific. Thank you. Right.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you. Okay, break time, and we'll come right back. Don't forget that the Pope has asked for prayers for peace, and I want to get my dates here. I believe it's the 29th, Saturday the 29th, given all the tension going on in Russia, between Russia and Ukraine and all the other countries who look like they might get into a fight. So if you want to get more about that particular date and how you can Pray for peace. You'll find more information at relevantradio.com. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Today's programming sponsored in part by St. Gregory Recovery Center. More information about their Catholic-centered recovery from substance abuse is available at relevantradio.com/stgregory.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, Lugger. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I'm your huckleberry.
You're a daisy if you do.
If I thought you were my friend, I just don't think I could bear it.
Why, John Aringo, you look like someone just walked over your grave.
It appears we must redefine the nature of our association.
In vino veritas.
You win.
I'll keep going.
I've got 1,000 of these, but I know you'll win.
I've even got the little tin cup that I'm flinging around on my finger as if it were a six shooter.
That's too fun.
I love. Could you tell that I like that movie?
We will have full conversations where it's nothing but Tombstone references, yep. And Patrick wins every time. I can't. I'll have a list of the quotes from the movie in front. I'll cheat and have all the quotes in front of me, and he'll still beat me.
You're no daisy.
All right.
Hey, I think Vice President Harris said something interesting yesterday, and I think you have the audio. Can we play that?
We are focused on the most vulnerable. And based on my experience, the most vulnerable are women and girls, racial and ethnic minorities, LGBTQI plus people, indigenous people, people with disabilities, migrants, and children in the foster care system. When we identify who is most vulnerable, we can tailor our tactics and improve our strategy.
That was a pretty long list. Let's see. The most vulnerable are women and
girls. And based on my experience, the most vulnerable are women and girls.
Okay.
Racial and ethnic minorities.
All right.
LGBTQI plus people. Indigenous people. People with disabilities.
Okay.
Migrants. And children in the foster care system.
Who am I to argue with that? I don't argue with that. I may have a difference of opinion perhaps as to how vulnerable. But, I mean, let's face it, LGBTQI people are probably the least vulnerable among us. Just if you want to find out, if you want to prove that point, say something negative about them on Twitter, and you will find out very quickly how non-vulnerable they are, but really how vulnerable you are if you were dare to even just express an opinion that might be critical. It used to be LGBT. Actually, it used to be LGB. Then it became LGBT. Now it's LGBTQ. Then it was LGBTQ+. Now it's LGBTQI+. I presume I stands for intersex. So I might quibble with her on that particular point with regard to just how vulnerable. She says they're among the most vulnerable. But am I missing something, Cyrus? Isn't there like a whole category of people who aren't on this list of people who are the most vulnerable? It seems to me there's like a bunch of people who should be on this list who aren't.
Yeah, it's like there's a whole bunch of people that should be in the world that aren't.
Yeah, those people. The people in the womb who aren't born yet. Some of whom are girls, by the way. Some of whom will wind up being LGBTQI plus people, don't you know? But apparently the people in these categories, I mean, let's face it, everybody who's unborn will wind up being either a male or a female, so women and girls. She doesn't define those terms, women and girls. Some of them will be racial and ethnic minorities. Some of these unborn people are going to be LGBTQI plus people. Some of them are indigenous people. Some of them will be people with disabilities. Some of the people who are unborn are going to be migrants. Some of the people who are unborn right now will be children in the foster care system. So I don't disagree with her premise. that we should be focused on the most vulnerable, but you've got all these people represented in her long list of different vulnerable groups, all of whom, in the case of those who are unborn, who will become members of those different classes or those different categories, but she doesn't have them on the list. So I think you need to go back to the drawing table, Vice President Harris, and try it again. And let me know when you have the list down and you've included the most vulnerable among us, who are the unborn children. When you have that on the list, then I think you and I can reach an agreement. Until then, though, I think you've missed the mark.
A man and a woman.
I trampled over that one. I don't want that on my karmic record.
No,
so
really
play it again, Sam. Play it again.
A man and a woman.
All right. Let's go to Billy in Springfield, Illinois. Hi, Billy.
Hi. I'm calling to ask you about 1 Timothy 2:14. It always jumps out at me. It says, okay. It was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman. Mm. And I know this chapter is about the conduct of men and women, but it always makes me think, did Adam stand with Eve to protect her? So like the new Adam is standing for his bride in her mm-hmm. error?
That's a very deep question. Excellent question. Yeah, so I'll offer a few thoughts. Number one, this is just a slight detail, but for what it's worth, typically, traditionally, we don't refer to the book as 1 Timothy or 1 Corinthians. We don't say 1 Peter. It's 1 Timothy or 1 Corinthians or 1 Peter. And I know sometimes people might hear it said that way, but for the sake of people understanding what you're referring to, I would just propose use the traditional form. But in any case, yes, this is referring to what we read in Genesis chapter 3, when, and I think I might have read it yesterday or the day before, where in the narrative we see that the serpent beguiled Eve. The serpent did not go to Adam, he went to Eve, and he beguiled her, he inveigled her, and she fell for it, and she went to the tree. Based on the narrative, Adam wasn't there. She went to the tree. She beheld that it was beautiful. She saw that the fruit would taste good. She took the tree from the took the fruit from the tree. She ate the fruit, and then she brought it to Adam. So in verse 14 here, the reference hearkening back to Genesis chapter 3 is kind of a condensed version of that narrative, that Adam was not deceived by the serpent. The woman was deceived by the serpent. And so she sinned first and then brought the sin, or brought the apple rather, to Adam. And I think I may have mentioned this yesterday when I discussed it, but the difference is that she was tricked, she was fooled, she was beguiled, you know, whatever the term is that we might want to use. Adam was not, and that's the key here, is that Adam's sin was far worse. It was far... There was far more malice involved in Adam's sin, because he had not been tricked. He saw this, as I think I said, you know, with a stone cold, sober clarity. He knew what he was about to do was wrong, and he did it anyway. The woman, Eve, was not as clear, it seems. She had more of an excuse, I guess you might say, even though it wasn't a good excuse. It was more, she had an excuse. But Adam did not have any excuse at all. So that's what this is referring to if you go back to Genesis chapter 3. Now, have I answered your question, or did I miss something
yes,
in what
because,
you're looking for?
That really says, you know, Jesus could not be in error. He would not be in error. So you
right.
can't really compare the two.
Right. Well, there is a typological connection between Adam and Jesus, and St. Paul makes this very clear in Romans chapter 5, that, and also, primarily in Romans chapter 5, where he talks about how through the first man, the first Adam, sin and death entered the world, but through the second Adam, Jesus, that the remedy for sin comes. So if you read Romans chapter 5, you'll see that there is indeed a typological bond between Adam and Jesus. But it's also kind of the reversal or the inverse of roles, meaning that just as Adam is the one who in full awareness and with complete malice committed this sin, and he didn't guard his wife. He didn't protect her from the evil one. Jesus, of course, is the opposite, because he's the fulfillment of Adam, and he does what Adam failed to do at a far higher level, of course.
I thank you for the clarity.
You're most welcome.
Very, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Billy. Great question. I love these questions. Let's go now to, let's go to Richard in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
Yes, Patrick. I have a question about my daughter is suffering from a condition called OCD, condition called scrupulosity.
Okay.
And she's being diagnosed with this through a licensed psychologist. And I was wanting to know if there is some books that I can read or some kind of something that I can do to help her to get through these periods when she has these periods of doubting God or doubting that everything she does is wrong or not doing God's will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if her scrupulosity is compounded by this clinical problem, then it is it's all the more difficult to deal with. So I don't know that I have a book that your 14-year-old daughter could read. I mean, I'd have to think about that. And maybe I can come up with something by tomorrow, Richard. In the meantime, however, there's a good book that you could read and you could glean from it some things that you could share with her. Or if you thought she was, you know, at the level where it would make sense to her. But two books that come to mind. One is called Making Sense Out of Suffering, and that's by Dr. Peter Kraft. The other book is called Arise from Darkness, What to Do When Life Doesn't Make Sense. Now, neither one of these books, Arise from Darkness. That book was written by Father Benedict Rochelle. Now, neither of these books is about scrupulosity, but both of them approach the question of how do you handle suffering that is spiritual? How do you deal with a spiritual cross? And I think that the advice that they both give in these two books will be helpful to her, either if she reads it for herself or if you filter it to her, if you read the books. But I think that would be a good start.
Okay, yep, I'll look into these at our Catholic bookstore or online if I can get them. Yeah. She's been, all my children, three children I have, were, you know, cradle Catholics, went through all the sacraments of confirmation, and now have fallen away from the church. They don't, they go to a Christian church. Mm-hmm. I'm divorced, and they stay with their mom some and then with me some. Mm-hmm. So they are saying that they don't understand. They don't understand the Catholic faith, but they understand the Christian faith. And that's where I think the conflict with her is, that she battles spirituality between faiths.
Yeah.
Because Catholic faith teaches one thing, and then the Christian, evangelical Christian church faith teaches something else. And
yeah, it's basically... Protestantism as the version of Christianity. But I hear what you're saying. So it sounds like at 14 years of age, poor thing's being pulled in two different directions. So as dad, hopefully you'll be a moderating influence where you can help her, you know, begin to see that there are differences in how we approach doctrine. I've mentioned a book from time to time called Surprised by Truth. And that's a book of conversion testimonies by former Protestants. I edited the book, full disclosure. But if you wanted to pick up a cheapo copy online for a couple of bucks used, that might be a book that you could give her, because it, the stories are riveting. And at 14 years of age, I'm sure she'd be able to read and understand it. And I think that could go a long, long way in helping her sort out some of these confusions about Catholic and Protestant. But I have to leave it at that. That, too, you can find at your local Catholic bookstore. Richard, I hope that's helpful. And I'll pray for your daughter that she gets the care that she needs and that she pulls out of this difficulty that she's in right now. Well, I'm looking forward to being with you all again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. And until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.